On Joseph. There are three forms through which the finest end is reached: learning, nature, and practice. And there are also three sages, the eldest according to Moses, named for these very things. Having written their lives, the one who learned by instruction, the one who was self-taught, and the one who trained by practice, I shall now write, forth in sequence, the life of the statesman, whose name in turn is borne by one of the tribal patriarchs, a man formed for statesmanship from his earliest years. He began, in fact, to be formed for it at about 17 years of age, through the principles of shepherding, which harmonize with the principles that govern a city. This, I think, is why the poetic tradition is accustomed to call kings shepherds of the peoples. For the man who has mastered shepherding would also make the best king, having been trained in matters that seem to deserve less effort, in the care of the finest flock of living creatures, human beings. And just as for the man who intends to command in war and lead an army, exercises in hunting are most necessary, in the same way, for those whose hope it is to govern a city, shepherding is most fitting, since it is a kind of preliminary training in oversight and command. His father, then, seeing in him a noble disposition, greater than that of a private man, admired and cherished him, and loved him more than his other sons, both because he was born to him in his old age, which is no less than anything else conducive to affection, and because, being a lover of what is fine, he kindled the boy's nature into flame through special and extraordinary attentions, so that it might not merely smolder but blaze up all the sooner. But envy, ever the adversary of great prosperity, then set upon a household that was flourishing in every part and turned brother against brother, arming many against one. And they, in a hatred that matched the father's affection for him, showed as much ill will as the measure of the love he was shown. Yet they did not speak their hatred aloud, but stored it up within themselves, and so, naturally enough, it grew all the more troublesome. For passions that are shut in and find no outlet through reasoned words become heavier. Now the boy, being of guileless character and not perceiving the enmity smoldering beneath the surface among his brothers, saw an auspicious dream and told it to them as though they were well disposed to him. "I thought," he said, "that the season of harvest had come and that all of us had gone into the field to gather in the crop and, taking sickles, were reaping. And suddenly my own sheaf rose up and stood erect, lifted on high, while yours, as though at a signal, ran up to it and, struck with awe, did obeisance to it with every mark of honor. But they, being sharp of understanding and clever at tracking down through signs a matter otherwise hidden by plausible conjectures, said, 'Do you suppose you will become our king and master? For this is what you are hinting at through your invented vision.' And their hatred blazed up all the more, ever seizing on some new pretext by which to grow. He, suspecting nothing, a few days later had another dream, more astonishing than the first, and reported it to his brothers, for he thought that the sun and the moon and 11 stars came and did obeisance to him. His father, marveling at what had happened, laid it up in his mind, storing it away and watching to see what would come of it. But he admonished the boy gravely, out of fear that he might go wrong in some way, and said, 'Shall we indeed be able, I and your mother and your brothers, to do obeisance to you? For by the sun you seem to signify your father, by the moon your mother, and by the 11 stars your 11 brothers. May this never enter your mind, my son, and may even the memory of what has appeared to you slip away and be forgotten. For to hope for and look forward to dominion over one's own kin is, in my judgment, a thing altogether to be shunned, and, I think, in the judgment of all who care for equality and the rights owed to kindred.' The father, being cautious lest some disturbance and discord should arise among the brothers from their living together, since they bore a grudge over the dreams against the one who had seen them, sent the others out to tend the flocks, but kept this one at home, watching over the proper time, knowing that time is said to be the physician of the soul's passions and sicknesses, capable of removing grief, quenching anger, and curing fear. For it eases everything, even those things that are by nature hard to heal. But when he judged that no hostility any longer lay hidden in their minds, he sent his son both to greet his brothers and, at the same time, to report how they and the flocks of their herds were faring. This journey came to be the beginning of great evils, and again, beyond all expectation, of great goods for both parties. For he, obeying his father's instructions, went to his brothers. But they, seeing him arriving from a distance, spoke to one another words of ill omen, since they did not even think him worthy to be addressed by name, but called him the dream-struck one, and the dreamer, and such names, and worked themselves up to such a pitch of anger that the greater part of them, though not all, plotted his murder, and in order not to be found out, resolved to kill him and throw him into a very deep pit dug in the earth. For there are many cisterns for rainwater in that region. And they came close to committing the greatest of impieties, fratricide, had they not, with difficulty, been persuaded by the pleas of the eldest, who urged them not to lay a hand upon this pollution themselves, but only to throw him into one of the pits, having in mind something that might save him, that after their departure he might take him out, unharmed by any evil, and send him back to their father. When they had agreed, he came up to them and greeted them. But they seized him as though he were an enemy, stripped off his robe, and let him down into deep pits, while the robe, stained with the blood of a kid, they sent to their father, with the pretext that he had been devoured by wild beasts. That very day, as it happened, some merchants were traveling by, of those accustomed to carry goods from Arabia to Egypt. And to them, drawing their brother up, they sold him, following the judgment of the one who was fourth in age. For this one, I think, fearing that he might be treacherously killed by those who kindled an implacable anger against him, advised that he be sold, exchanging slavery for death, a lighter evil for a greater one. But the eldest, for he had not been present when he was sold, peered down and not seeing the one he had left there only a little before, cried out and shouted, and tearing his garments was carried this way and that as though out of his mind, clapping his hands and pulling his hair, saying, "What has happened to him? Tell me, does he live or is he dead? If he is no more, show me his corpse, that I may weep over the fallen body and find relief from my misfortune. Seeing him laid out, I shall be consoled. Why should we bear a grudge even against the dead? Toward those who are gone, no envy arises. But if he lives, to what part of the earth has he gone? With whom is he kept? For surely I too am not under suspicion, as he was, that I should be disbelieved." When they told him that he had been sold, and showed him the price, he said, "A fine piece of business you have transacted. Let us divide the profits. Let us contend with slave traders for the prize of wickedness, and wear the victor's crown, taking pride in outdoing them in cruelty. They deal so against strangers, but we against our own closest and dearest kin. A great reproach has now been freshly created, a notorious disgrace. Our fathers left behind, throughout the whole inhabited world, monuments of nobility of character. And shall we too leave behind incurable slanders of faithlessness and hatred of humankind? For the reports of great deeds outrun everything, everywhere, admired when they concern what is praiseworthy, but meeting blame and accusation when they concern what is culpable. In what manner, then, will our father receive the news of what has happened? You have made a life not worth living for one who was thrice blessed and thrice fortunate. Will he pity the one who was sold for his slavery or those who sold him for their cruelty? I know well it will be far more for us, since to do wrong is harder to bear than to suffer it. For the one who suffers wrong is helped by two very great things, pity and hope, while the one who does wrong, sharing in neither, is condemned by every judge. But why do I go on lamenting these things uselessly? It is better to be silent, lest I too suffer some dreadful thing myself. For men are most harsh and implacable when angry, and the passion in each of them still blows fierce and strong. When the father heard, not the truth, that his son had been sold, but the lie that he was dead and had been devoured by wild beasts, struck both in his ears by what was said and in his eyes by what was shown him, for the boy's tunic, torn, mutilated, and drenched with much blood, had been brought to him, he was overwhelmed by his suffering and lay speechless for a very long time, unable even to lift his head, so crushed and broken was he by the calamity. Then, suddenly letting loose a fountain of tears, with bitter wailing he drenched his cheeks, his beard, and his chest, and his garments too, all the while saying such things as these: "It is not his death that grieves me, child, but its manner. If you had been buried in your own land, I would have been consoled. I would have tended you, nursed you in your sickness, shared with you your last embraces as you died, closed your eyes, wept over your body as it lay there, given you a costly funeral, and left out none of the customary rites. But even if it had happened in a foreign land, I would have said, 'Nature has only received back what was owed to her. Do not grieve, my friend. One's homeland belongs to the living, but for the dead every land is a grave.' No man dies too soon, or rather all men do, for even the longest lived is short-lived when measured against eternity. But if indeed he had to die by violence, through a plot, it would have been a lighter evil for me had he been killed by men, who, having slain him, would yet have pitied his corpse, so as to heap up earth and cover the body from sight. And even had they been the cruelest of all men, what more could they have gained than to cast him out unburied and go their way? And perhaps someone passing by on the road might have stopped, and seeing him, taken pity on our common nature, and thought him worthy of care and burial. But now, as the story goes, you have become a banquet and a feast for savage, flesh-devouring beasts who have tasted and feasted on my very own flesh and blood. If I had to die by violence, by a plot against me, that would have been a lighter evil for me, killed by men who, having slain me, would still have pitied my corpse enough to heap up dust and cover my body. But even if they had become the cruelest of all, what more would they have gained than to fling me down unburied and go their way? Some passerby on the road might perhaps have stopped, and on seeing me, moved by pity for our common nature, thought me worthy of care and burial. But now, as the story goes, you have become a banquet and feast for savage flesh-eating beasts, who have tasted and feasted on my very own flesh and blood. I am an athlete of misfortunes I never chose, trained at random through many hardships, wandering, living as a stranger, serving as a slave, coerced, even plotted against as far as my very life, by those who least should have done so. I have seen much, heard much, and myself suffered countless irreparable things, and though schooled by them to moderate my feelings, I was not bent. But nothing that has now befallen me is more unbearable. It has overturned and demolished the strength of my soul. For what grief is greater or more pitiable than this? My son's garment has been brought back to me, his father, but of him not a part, not a limb, not the smallest remnant. He has been utterly and wholly consumed, without even being able to share in burial, while the garment, it seems to me, would not have been sent to me at all, except to remind me of my anguish and renew what I have endured into griefs unforgettable and unceasing for me. Such were his lamentations. Meanwhile, the merchants sold the boy in Egypt to one of the king's eunuchs, the chief cook. It is worth adding, after the literal narrative, what lies in its hidden meanings, for nearly all, or most, of the legislation is allegorized. Now the character under examination is called, among the Hebrews, Joseph, and among the Greeks, addition of a lord, a name most apt and most fitting to the thing signified, for civic administration organized by peoples is an addition to nature, whose authority holds sway over all things. For this great city, the cosmos, is one, and it employs a single constitution and a single law. And this law is reason, the ordinance of nature, which commands what must be done and forbids what must not be done. But these cities arranged by locality are unbounded in number, and employ differing constitutions and not the same laws, for different peoples have different customs and statutes, devised and added on. The cause of this is the lack of mixture and community, not only of Greeks toward barbarians or barbarians toward Greeks, but also of each race, taken separately, toward its own kindred. Then, it seems, blaming what is not to blame, unwelcome seasons, failure of crops, poverty of soil, a location that is coastal or inland or on an island or on the mainland, or other such things of like kind, they pass over the truth in silence. But the true cause is greed and mutual distrust, on account of which, not content with the ordinances of nature, they have proclaimed as laws whatever seemed advantageous in common to those of like mind gathered together. And so it stands to reason that the particular constitutions are additions, each to the one constitution according to nature. For the laws of individual cities are additions to nature's right reason, and the statesman is an addition to the one who lives according to nature. It is not, then, beside the point that he is said to take up a coat of many colors, Genesis 37:3. For civic administration is many-colored and versatile, admitting countless changes, of persons, of circumstances, of causes, of the particular character of actions, of differences in occasions and places. For just as a helmsman changes his aids toward good sailing along with the changing winds, steering his vessel by no single method, and a physician employs no single treatment for all who are ill, nor even for one patient, since the ailment does not remain constant, but watching for relaxations, intensifications, fillings, emptyings, changes of cause, varies these remedies toward safety, applying now this and now that. So too, I think. The statesman must necessarily be a man of many forms and many shapes, one sort in peace, another in war. Another again when few or when many combine against him, vigorously rising up against the few, but dealing with the many through persuasion. And where existence involves danger, outstripping others for the common good by his own action, but where the matter calls for deliberation, withdrawing and letting others serve. It is well said, however, that the man is sold. For the demagogue and public speaker, mounting the platform, becomes, like slaves put up for sale, a slave instead of a free man through the honors he thinks he is receiving, led off by countless masters. And this same man is also brought in as one caught by wild beasts, for vainglory lying in ambush is an untamed beast, seizing and destroying those who indulge it. And those who have bought him sell him again in turn. For the one who governs is master not of one but of a crowd, one after another in succession and rotation. And these thrice-sold men, in the manner of wretched servants, keep changing their masters, unable to endure their former ones because of the fickle and novelty-loving instability of their characters. So much, then, for these matters. As for the young man, once he had been brought to Egypt and had come, as was said, into the possession of a eunuch master, within a few days he gave proof of his nobility and good character, and received charge over his fellow slaves and care of the whole household. For by now his owner had confirmed, through many signs, that the young man's every word and deed came not without divine providence. In appearance, then, he was appointed steward of the household by the one who had bought him, but in fact and in truth, by nature, which was already preparing him for the leadership of cities and a nation and a great country. For the man destined to become a statesman had first to be trained and practiced in matters of household management. For a house is a city compressed and small, and household management, a kind of constitution drawn together, just as a city is a great household, and a constitution a kind of common household management. By these facts, it is made especially clear that the same man is both householder and statesman, even though the subjects over which he presides differ in number and magnitude, just as it is in painting and sculpture. For the good sculptor or painter, whether he fashions many colossal figures or few and smaller ones, displays the same art and is the same man. Now, while he was highly esteemed in his management of the household, he became the object of a plot by his master's wife, a plot born of unchaste desire. For she, maddened with passion for the young man's beauty and raging uncontrollably in her affliction, pressed on him proposals of intercourse with all vigor, though he resisted with strength and would not entertain them at all, because of the propriety and self-control that were his by nature and by practice. But when, though she kept stirring and inflaming her lawless desire, she kept trying again and again and again failing, she resorted at last to force, and seizing his garment, dragged him vigorously all the way to the bed with mightier strength, her passion lending her power, passion which is accustomed to give sinew even to the weakest. But he, proving stronger than the present crisis, burst out with words befitting a free man worthy of his lineage. "Why do you use force?" he said. "We, the descendants of the Hebrews, follow distinctive customs and laws. To others it is permitted, after the 14th year of life, to consort with prostitutes and streetwalkers and all who hire out their bodies, with full license. But among us it is not even lawful for a courtesan to live," Deuteronomy 23:17, "and against the woman who plays the harlot, death has been fixed as the penalty. Before lawful marriage, we know no intercourse with another woman, but chaste, we come to chaste virgins, setting as our goal not pleasure but the begetting of legitimate children. Having kept myself pure up to this very day, I will not begin to transgress the law with adultery, the greatest of wrongs, since I am obliged, even had I spent the rest of my time dissolutely, driven by the impulses of youth and emulating the luxury of this land, still not to hunt after another man's marriage. And at this, what man does not feel murderous rage? For though men are accustomed to disagree about everything else, on this alone, in complete agreement everywhere, all have judged it worthy of countless deaths, handing over the guilty, without trial, to those who have caught them. But you, lavishly generous, add for me a threefold pollution, bidding me not merely commit adultery, but corrupt a mistress, my master's own wife. Unless indeed this is why I came into your household, that abandoning the services a servant must render, I should grow drunk, and behave with the insolence of drunkenness toward the hopes of the man who bought me, adulterating his marriage, his household, his kinship. But no, I am led to honor him now not only as master, but already as benefactor. He has entrusted all his affairs to me, withholding nothing whatever, small or great, apart from you, his wife. In return for this, is it fitting that I repay him with what you urge? Fine gifts, it seems, I would be giving in exchange for the favors already bestowed on me as one of his household. My master, though I was a captive and a stranger, has by his kindnesses made me, as far as lies in his power, a free man and a citizen. And shall I, the slave, treat my master as though he were the stranger and the captive? With what soul could I take on myself this unholy deed? With what eyes shall I, iron-hearted as I would be, look upon anyone? My own conscience, laying hold of me, will not allow me to look at people with straight eyes, even if I should manage to escape notice. But I shall escape notice in no way at all, for there are countless examiners of deeds done in secret, for whom it is not lawful to keep still. I say nothing of the fact that, even if no one else perceives it, or perceiving it does not denounce me, I myself will nonetheless become my own informer against myself. Through my color, my look, my voice, convicted, as I said a moment ago, by my own conscience. And even if no one else will denounce me, do we neither fear nor feel shame before God's assessor and overseer of all deeds. As he wove together many such words and reasoned on, she was deaf to all of it, for desires are terrible things, able to overshadow even the most exact of the senses. Perceiving this, he fled, leaving his garments behind in her hands, which had taken hold of them. This gave her the material to devise pretexts against the young man, by which she would take revenge on him. For when her husband returned from the marketplace, feigning modesty and propriety and great displeasure at licentious conduct, she said, "You have brought us a Hebrew boy as a servant, who has not only already corrupted your soul, since you entrusted him with the household easily and without scrutiny, but he even dared to violate my body. For it was not enough for him to make use of my fellow slaves alone, having become utterly wanton and lustful. He attempted also to seduce his mistress and to force himself on me. And the proofs of his derangement are clear and evident. For when, overcome with distress, I cried out and called for those inside to help me, he, terrified because of his recklessness, left his garment behind and fled, fearing to be caught. And in displaying this garment, she seemed to offer proof of what she said. His master, believing these things to be true, ordered the man to be led away to prison, erring in two very grave respects. First, that without giving him a chance to defend himself, he condemned, without a trial, one who had done no wrong as though he had committed the gravest crime. Second, that the garment, which the woman produced as having been left behind by the young man, was proof of violence, not the violence he had committed, but the endurance he had endured at the hands of the woman. For it is the mark of one committing violence to hold fast to the garment of his mistress, but of one suffering violence to have his own garment torn from him. Perhaps he is to be forgiven for his excessive lack of education, since he made his living in a kitchen full of blood and smoke and ash, where reasoning has no opportunity to find calm and leisure for itself, because he is more caught up in confusion than not, no less than his body is. He has now sketched three types of the statesman: the pastoral, the domestic, and the self-controlled. Of the first two, he has already spoken. The self-controlled type contributes no less than they to statesmanship. Self-control is profitable and salutary for all the affairs of life, but especially for those of the city, as anyone who wishes to learn may see readily and most plainly. For who does not know the disasters that incontinence has brought upon nations and lands and whole regions of the inhabited world, on land and sea? For most of the greatest wars have arisen through erotic passions, adulteries, and the deceptions of women, by which the greater and better part both of the Greek and of the barbarian race was consumed, and the youth of the cities destroyed. But if the products of incontinence are civil strife, wars, and evils upon evils beyond telling, it is clear that the products of self-control are stability and peace, and the possession and enjoyment of perfect goods. It is worthwhile also to set forth, in due order, what is signified through these things. The eunuch who bought the man on trial is said to be the chief judge, fittingly. For the crowd that purchases the statesman is, in truth, a eunuch, possessing the organs of generation in appearance only, but deprived of the powers for generation, just as those whose eyes have been overlaid with cataract, though possessing eyes, are deprived of the function that comes through the eyes, being unable to see. What then is the resemblance to a crowd of eunuchs? That it is barren of wisdom while seeming to practice virtue. For whenever a mixed and promiscuous multitude of people comes together into one, it says what is fitting, but thinks and does the opposite, accepting the counterfeit before the genuine, for the sake of being overcome by reputation rather than practicing what is truly good. Hence also, the most absurd thing, a woman lives with this eunuch. For the crowd woos desire as a husband woos a wife, and through her it both speaks and does everything, making her counselor of all things spoken and unspoken, small and great alike, being least accustomed to attend to the dictates of reason. Most fittingly indeed, he also calls him chief cook. For just as a cook practices nothing else but the endless and excessive pleasures of the belly, in the same way the political crowd practices, through hearing, delights and indulgences, by which the sinews of the mind are relaxed, and in a manner of speaking, the nerves of the soul are unstrung. And who does not know the difference between doctors and cooks? The former prepare with all diligence only what is healthful, even if it should not happen to be pleasant, while the latter, on the contrary, take no account of what is beneficial, considering only what is pleasant. Laws among a people, then, resemble doctors, and so do the magistrates who govern according to the laws, counselors and judges, who care for the safety and security of the common good without flattery. But the numerous throngs of the young resemble sauce makers. For what concerns them is not what will be advantageous, but only how they may reap pleasure in the present moment alone. And the desire of the crowds for the statesman is amorous, like an unchaste woman, and it says to him, "Come now, sir, into the crowd with which I live, and forget all your own habits, pursuits, words, and deeds in which you were raised. Obey me instead, attend to me, and do all the things that are pleasurable to me." For a companion who is austere and outspoken and truthful and scrupulously just, who behaves with gravity and solemnity toward everyone and yields to nothing, holding fast always to the advantageous alone, without flattering his listeners, such a one I cannot bear. I will heap countless slanders against you before my husband, the crowd, your master. For up till now you seem to me to be playing the freedman, and you are altogether ignorant that you have become the slave of a tyrannical master. But if you knew that acting on one's own initiative is most proper to the free man, but foreign to the household slave, you would have learned to set aside your self-will and look instead to his wife, that is, desire, and to do what pleases me, by which above all you will give satisfaction. But the true statesman is not ignorant that the people hold despotic power, yet he will not confess himself a slave but a free man, the satisfaction of the soul. Rather, he will say outright, "I neither learned nor will I ever practice flattering the populace, but having been entrusted with the leadership and care of the city, I will exercise it as a good guardian or a well-disposed father, without deceit and purely, without hostile pretense. Holding these convictions, I will be put to the test, concealing and hiding nothing, in the manner of a thief, but making my conscience shine as in sunlight and daylight, for truth is light. And I will fear nothing that anyone may threaten, even if death is the threat. For to me there is no evil more grievous than death, namely, the pretense of such men. For whose sake should I endure it? For even if the people is my master, I am not a slave, but well born if anyone is, aspiring to enrollment as a citizen in the greatest and best commonwealth, this cosmos. For when neither gifts nor entreaties, nor love of honors, nor desire for office nor boastfulness, nor the longing for appearances, nor licentiousness, nor cowardice, nor injustice, nor anything else that comes from passion or vice can sway me, of what mastery shall I still be afraid? Clearly only that which comes from men. But these men lay claim only to lordship over the body, not over what belongs to me. For I derive my standing from what is superior, the understanding within myself, according to which I have prepared myself to live, caring little for my mortal body, which, clinging to me like a shell to an oyster, may be maltreated by some, yet, being released from the harsh masters and mistresses within, I shall not be grieved, having escaped the heaviest necessity. If then I must judge, I shall judge neither favoring the rich because of his wealth, nor the poor because of pity for his misfortunes. But veiling the rank and outward show of the litigants, I shall award without deceit whatever shall appear to be just. And if I must give counsel, I shall propose opinions that serve the common good, even if they are not pleasing. And if I must address the assembly, I shall leave flattering speeches to others and shall use words that are salutary and beneficial, rebuking, admonishing, correcting, having practiced not raving and frenzied self-will, but sober frankness of speech. But if someone takes no pleasure in these improvements, let him rebuke also parents and guardians and teachers and all who have the care of others, because they speak ill of their legitimate children and orphan wards and pupils, and sometimes even strike them, acts to which it is not right to attach the name of insult or outrage, but rather, on the contrary, the names of friendship and goodwill. For it would be utterly unworthy that I, a statesman entrusted with all the affairs of the people, should prove inferior, in reasonings concerning the common good, to someone practicing the art of medicine. That man, after all, gave no thought to the outward splendor of his patient in what people call good fortune, not that he was well-born, or wealthy, or the most illustrious king or ruler of his time, but held to one thing alone, saving him as far as he could, and if cutting or cauterizing was needed, the subject and so-called slave burns and cuts his ruler and master. But I, taking in hand not one man, but a whole city sick with more grievous diseases, diseases that its own inborn desires had produced, what ought I to do? Should I let go of what benefits everyone in common, and instead tend this or that person's ears with servile and thoroughly slavish flattery? I would rather die than conceal the truth by saying something for the sake of pleasure, and neglect what is advantageous. Against this, as the tragic poet says, let fire come, let the sword come, burn, scorch my flesh, drink your fill of my dark blood. Sooner shall the stars go down beneath the earth and the earth rise up into the sky than a flattering word from me shall come to meet you. So then, when a resolve has become manly in this way, and stands outside all the passions, pleasure, fear, grief, desire, the sovereign populace cannot endure the statesman who possesses it. Instead, it seizes him as an enemy and punishes the man who is well-disposed and a friend, and in doing so punishes itself first, with the greatest of punishments, namely ignorance, on account of which it never learned to be ruled the finest and most beneficial thing, from which the capacity to rule itself also arises. Having now discussed these matters sufficiently, let us look at what follows. The young man, slandered by the woman he loved who had fabricated to his master charges that reversed the truth, charges of which she herself was guilty, was led away to prison without even obtaining a defense. And once in the jail, he displayed such greatness of virtue that even the most depraved of those there were struck with wonder and amazement, and supposed they had found in the man a remedy against evils, a comfort for their misfortunes. No one is ignorant of how much inhumanity and savagery jailers are full of. By nature they are pitiless, and by practice they are hardened, growing more brutish every day toward savagery, seeing and saying and doing nothing decent, not even by chance, but only what is most violent and harsh. For just as men who are well built in body, when they add athletic training, gain an invincible strength and an outstanding condition, in the same way, when an untamed and unsociable nature adds training toward savagery, it becomes doubly unreachable and inaccessible to pity, to that good and humane feeling. For just as those who keep company with good people improve their characters by delighting in their companions, so too those who live with wicked people take on something of their vice, for habit has a terrible power to make one like its object and to force one against nature. Do jailers, then, spend their time with cloak snatchers, thieves, with housebreakers, violent men, the brutal, seducers, murderers, adulterers, temple robbers, and from each of these they draw off some portion of depravity and gather it together, and out of the promiscuous mixture produce one single evil, utterly confused and utterly polluted. but even such a man was tamed by the young man's nobility of character, and not only granted him safety and a truce, but even authority over all the prisoners, so that in name only, for the sake of appearance, did he remain the jailer, while in actual practice, he had yielded his office to the young man, through whom no small benefit came to those who had been led away to prison. Indeed, they no longer thought it fitting even to call the place a prison, but a house of correction. For instead of the tortures and punishments which they used to endure night and day, being beaten and bound, and suffering every kind of evil, they were filled with the words and doctrines of philosophy, and with deeds more effective than any argument on the part of the one who taught them. For he set his own life in their midst, like a well-crafted archetype of self-control and every virtue, and turned around even those who seemed altogether incurable, whose long-standing diseases of the soul now abated. And they reproached themselves for what they had done, repented, and cried out such things as this: "Where, then, was so great a good all this time, at which we stumbled from the start? For now that it is shown upon us, we see our own disorder as in a mirror, and are ashamed." While men were being improved in this way, two eunuchs of the king were brought in the chief cupbearer, and the chief baker accused and condemned in the matters entrusted to them. He took the same care of these men as of the others, praying that he might be able to make those under him no worse than men beyond reproach. When not much time had passed, going about among the prisoners, he saw the eunuchs full of gloom and dejection more than before, and conjecturing from the intensity of their grief that something new had befallen them, he inquired the cause. When they answered that they had seen dreams and were filled with distress and anguish, there being no one to interpret them, he said, "Take courage and tell them, for they will become known, if God so wills, and God wills to uncover things that are hidden, for those who long for the truth." Then the chief cupbearer spoke first. "I dreamed that a great vine had grown up from three roots, a single, most flourishing stalk, in full leaf and bearing clusters as at the height of the fruit season. And as the grape was beginning to ripen, I picked the clusters and pressed them into the royal cup, which held enough to bring undiluted wine to the king." He, pausing a little, said, "Your vision proclaims good fortune to you, and the recovery of your former office. For the three roots of the vine signify 3 days, after which the king will remember you and, sending for you from here, will grant you amnesty, and will allow you to resume the same position. And to confirm your restoration to office, you will pour wine for him, handing the cup to your master." And the man rejoiced to hear this. But the chief baker, having welcomed the interpretation, since he too had seen a fortunate-seeming dream, though it was in fact quite the reverse, was deceived by the good hopes given the other man, and said, "I too dreamed that I was carrying baskets, and bore on my head 3 baskets full of pastries. The topmost, 1 full of every kind that the king is accustomed to use, for the elaborate arts of bakers catering to the royal diet are varied. And birds swooped down and snatched from my head and gorged themselves insatiably, until they had consumed everything and left nothing of what had been prepared." He said, "I could have wished that this vision had not appeared to you at all, or, once it had appeared, that it had been kept quiet, or, if someone had to tell it, that the telling had at least stayed far from my ears, so that I would not have heard it. For I am reluctant, if anyone is, to be a messenger of evil, and I share the suffering of those in misfortune, being pained on account of my humanity no less than those who must endure it. But since it is necessary for interpreters of dreams to speak truly, as they explain and prophesy divine oracles, I will speak, holding nothing back. For to be truthful is best in all things, but concerning divine pronouncements, it is also the most sacred duty. The 3 baskets are a symbol of 3 days. After these have passed, the king will order that you be impaled and your head cut off, and birds swooping down will feast on your flesh until you are entirely consumed." And the man, as one might expect, was thrown into confusion and overturned, anxiously awaiting the appointed time and receiving in his mind, in advance, all its distress. When the 3 days had passed, the king's birthday arrived, on which everyone throughout the land held festival, and above all those attached to the palace. So while those in office were feasting, and the household staff were making merry as at a public banquet, he remembered the eunuchs in the prison and ordered them brought. And having observed what came of the interpretation of the dreams, he set his seal upon it, commanding that the one be impaled after his head was cut off, and that to the other the office he had formerly administered be restored. But once restored, the chief cupbearer forgot the one who had foretold his restoration, and had lightened each of the misfortunes that had befallen him, perhaps, because every ungrateful person is forgetful of benefactors, but perhaps also because God, in his providence, willed that the young man's good fortune should come about not through a human being, but through himself. For after 2 years had passed, the good and evil things destined to befall the land were foretold to the king through a dream in twin visions, signifying the same thing, for the sake of a more certain conviction. For it seemed that 7 cows came up out of the river, fat and very well fleshed and beautiful to see, and grazed beside the banks. After them, an equal number of others, somehow fleshless and shriveled to skeletons and utterly repulsive, came up and grazed alongside the first. Then suddenly the worse cows devoured the better ones, and their bellies gained nothing at all, not even the slightest bit in bulk from having gorged themselves, but were left just as thin or even thinner. Rising up again and falling back asleep, he was struck by another vision. He thought 7 ears of wheat grew up from a single stalk, exactly equal in size, and, growing and flourishing, rose to a very sturdy height. Then 7 other ears, thin and weak, sprouted up nearby, and these, running upon the fine-eared stalk, swallowed it up. Having seen this vision, he spent the rest of the night sleepless, for his anxieties kept goading and wounding him, and at daybreak he summoned the sages and related the vision to them. Since no one was able to track down the truth by likely conjecture, the chief cupbearer came forward and said, "Master, there is hope of finding the man you seek. When you were angry with me and the chief baker, you ordered us led away to the prison, where there was a Hebrew, servant of the chief cook, to whom both he and I related the dreams that had appeared to us. And he interpreted them so aptly and so accurately that everything he foretold for each of us came to pass, for him, the punishment he suffered, and for me, the finding of your favor and goodwill." On hearing this, the king ordered them to hurry and summon the young man. So they cut his hair, for it had grown thick and long, both head and beard, during his confinement, and gave him bright clothing in place of filthy rags, and after grooming him in other ways, they brought him in before the king. The king, judging from his appearance that he was a free man of noble birth, for certain marks appear on the bodies of those we see that are not visible to everyone, but only to those whose minds I seize keenly, said, "My soul divines that the dreams will not remain wholly overshadowed in obscurity, for this young man shows a sign of wisdom, and he will uncover the truth, and, like light dispelling darkness, will scatter through his knowledge the ignorance of the sages we have here." And he related the dreams. And the man, in no way overawed by the dignity of the speaker, as though he were king and the king were not, spoke with candor mixed with respect, and said, "Whatever God is about to do in the land, he has already announced to you beforehand. But do not suppose that the two visions are two separate dreams. It is one dream, its doubling not superfluous but meant, for greater certainty, to confirm belief. For the 7 fat cows and the well-grown, flourishing 7 ears of grain signify 7 years of abundance and prosperity, and the 7 other years of famine are signified by the 7 lean and repulsive cows that came up afterward, and by the withered and blighted 7 ears of grain. So there will come first a 7-year period bringing great and abundant fruitfulness, the river flooding the fields every year, and the plains yielding a harvest such as never before. And after this there will come, in turn, another 7-year period, the opposite of the first, bringing harsh want and scarcity of necessities, the river neither rising nor the earth growing rich, so that the former abundance will be forgotten, and whatever remnant of the old prosperity there was will be consumed. Such, then, is the meaning of the interpretation. But the divine whispers within me and speaks aloud, suggesting remedies fitting for what is, in effect, a sickness, and the heaviest sickness of cities and lands is famine, against which a weakening must be contrived, lest, growing to its full strength, it devour the inhabitants. How, then, will it be weakened? Of the produce of the 7 years of plenty, the surplus left over after feeding the people sufficiently, it will perhaps be 1/5 part, must be stored up in city and villages, not transporting the harvest from afar, but keeping them, in whatever district they are grown, for the relief of those who live there. And the grain should be gathered in with its very sheaves, neither threshed nor winnowed at all, for 4 reasons. First, so that, kept undercover, it may remain uncorrupted for a longer time. Second, so that each year, when threshed and winnowed, it may serve as a reminder of the abundance, for the imitation of true goods was bound to produce a second pleasure. Third, so that it may not even be reduced to a reckoning, the amount of grain in ear and sheaf remaining unclear and beyond written account, lest the minds of the local people despair as they calculate the sum being consumed, but rather, keeping up their spirits through the better nourishment of grain, for hope above all sustains, they may lighten the heavy sickness of want. And fourth, so that fodder may be stored up for the cattle as well, from the chaff and husks separated out in the cleaning of the grain. And a man must be appointed overseer of these things, who is exceedingly prudent and intelligent and approved in every respect, one able to carry out what has been prescribed without provoking hatred or friction, giving the people no sense at all of the coming famine. For it is a hard thing for souls already worn down by toil to collapse into despair. And if anyone asks the reason, he will say that just as in peacetime one must provide beforehand for the preparations needed in war, so in times of plenty one must provide for what comes with want. For wars and famines, and in general the seasons of misfortune, are unforeseeable, and one must of necessity be prepared to meet them, rather than seek the remedy only once they have arrived, when it is of no use. When the king heard both the interpretation of the dreams, aimed so aptly and accurately at the truth, and the advice, which seemed most beneficial in providing for an unknown future, he ordered those present to draw nearer, so that no one else might overhear, and said, "Shall we find, men, such a man as this, who has a divine spirit within him?" When they all joined in approving and praising this, he looked at the one standing near him and said, "The man you urge me to seek is near. The prudent and intelligent man you bid me look for, according to your own account, is not far off, you yourself happen to be he. For it does not seem to me that you could say these things without God. Come, then, and take charge of the oversight of my household and the governance of all Egypt. And no one will accuse me of rashness, as though I acted out of self-love, that incurable passion. For great natures are not proven by long stretches of time. The very weight of their power compels immediate recognition, and affairs of state do not tolerate delay and procrastination when the times press for the necessary preparations." Then he made him successor to the kingship. Or rather, to speak the truth, king, keeping for himself only the name of the office while yielding to him the actual conduct of rule in practice, and doing everything else that concerned the young man's honor, the honor of the young man. So he gave him a royal seal and sacred robes and a golden chain for his neck, and having set him in the second chariot, ordered him to be driven around the city, a herald going ahead and proclaiming his appointment to those who did not know of it. And he renamed him, addressing him in the local tongue by a name recalling his skill in dream interpretation, and betrothed to him in marriage the most illustrious woman in Egypt, the daughter of the priest of Heliopolis. This happened when he was already about 30 years old. Such are the endings that await the pious. Even if they fall, they do not fall utterly, but rise up again and stand firm and secure, so as never again to be tripped up. For who would have expected that the same man, in a single day, would pass from slave to master, from prisoner to the most honored of all? That the underling of the prison keeper would become deputy of the king, and would dwell in the palace instead of the prison, carried to the highest place of honor instead of the lowest depths of disgrace. Yet this has happened, and will happen many times again, whenever it seems good to God. Only let some spark of true goodness smolder in the soul, which, when fanned, must at some point inevitably burst into flame. Since it is now proposed, after the literal exposition, to examine the more figurative sense as well, we must say what is fitting about that too. Perhaps some of the more frivolous will laugh when they hear this. But I will say without holding back that the true statesman is, in every respect, an interpreter of dreams, not one of the buffoons, nor of those who babble and play the sophist for hire and make the interpretation of nighttime visions a matter of profit, but one accustomed to give a precise account of the great dream, common to all and shared by the whole people, belonging not only to those asleep, but also to those awake. This dream, to put it with complete honesty, is the life of human beings. For just as in the visions we see during sleep we look, but do not see, hear but do not hear, taste or touch without either tasting or touching, speak without speaking, walk without walking, and seem to make use of all our other movements and postures, while making use of none of them at all, our minds being empty, picturing to themselves and forming images of things that are not, as though they were real, with nothing genuine underlying them, so too the impressions of us who are awake resemble dreams. They come, they go, they appear, they vanish. Before they can be firmly grasped, they have already flown away. Let each of us examine himself, and he will know the proof of this from his own experience, without needing any arguments of mine, especially anyone who has already reached an advanced age. This man was once an infant, and after that a child, then a boy, then a youth, then a young man again, then a man, and finally an old man. But where are all those former selves now? Did not the infant slip away within the child? The child within the boy just past childhood, the boy within the youth within the young man within the man, and the man within the old man, and does not death follow upon old age? Perhaps, indeed, perhaps each of the ages, yielding its dominance to the one that follows, dies before it, nature quietly teaching us not to fear the death that comes at the end of all things, since we have borne the earlier deaths so easily, the death of the boy who became a youth, of the youth who became a young man, of the young man who became a man, none of whom any longer exists once old age has set in. And all the other things that concern the body, are they not dreams as well? Is not beauty a thing of a day, withering before it is even flowered? Is not health unstable, beset by the illnesses that lie in wait for it? Is not strength easily overtaken by disease from countless causes? And the precision of the senses, is it not, far from being fixed, overturned by the onset of even a slight discharge? And who does not know the obscurity of external things? In a single day, great fortunes have often drained away. Countless people, having carried off the first prizes among the highest honors, have changed places with the neglected and the obscure, falling into disgrace. The greatest kingships of kings have been overthrown in a brief turn of fortune. Dionysius of Corinth vouches for what I say, he who was tyrant of Sicily, but on being cast out of his rule fled to Corinth, and this great ruler became a schoolmaster. Croesus, king of Lydia, joins him as a witness, the richest of kings, who, hoping to destroy the empire of the Persians, not only lost his own besides, but was also taken captive and came close to being burned alive. Witnesses to these dreams are not only individual men, but also cities, nations, and lands, Greece, the barbarian world, the mainland peoples, the islanders, Europe, Asia, West, and East. For nothing anywhere has remained utterly the same. Everything, throughout everything, has undergone reversals and changes. Egypt once held dominion over many nations, but now it is enslaved. The Macedonians flourished for a time to such a degree that they fastened the mastery of the whole inhabited world upon themselves, but now they pay the yearly tribute imposed by their masters to the tax collectors. Where now is the house of the Ptolemies, and the splendor of each successive king that blazed out to the ends of land and sea? Where are the freedoms of the self-governing nations and cities? And where, in turn, are the servitudes of subject peoples? Did not the Persians once rule over Parthia, while now, because of the reversals of human affairs and their moves up and down and shifts back and forth like pieces on a game board, the Parthians rule over the Persians? Some people fashion for themselves long and unending prosperities, yet these very beginnings are the sources of great evils. And hastening toward what they think will be an inheritance of good things, they find terrible misfortunes instead, while others, expecting the opposite misfortune, meet with good things. Athletes who pride themselves greatly on their powers, their strength, and the good condition of their bodies, and who expect an undoubted victory, have often been disqualified from the contest without even being tested, or have entered the contest and been defeated, while others who despaired of winning even second prize have taken up the first of the prizes and worn the victor's crown. Some who put out to sea in summer, for that is the season for safe sailing, have been shipwrecked, while others who expected to be capsized in winter have been carried safely through to harbor without danger. Some merchants strain after gains they consider certain, unaware of the losses lying in wait for them, while others, reckoning that they would suffer harm, have instead enjoyed great profits. So uncertain are our fortunes in either direction, and human affairs, as if on a scale, are weighed down or lightened by unequal weights. A terrible obscurity and thick darkness is poured over events. As in deep sleep, we wander unable to grasp anything with precision of reasoning, nor to lay hold of anything firmly and securely, for our experience resembles shadows and phantoms. And just as in processions the first participants pass by, escaping our sight, and in mountain torrents the moving current outruns our grasp by the swiftness of its flow, so too the affairs of life, being carried along and passing by, present the appearance of standing still, yet do not remain even for an instant, but are forever swept away. And those who are awake, insofar as concerns the instability of what they grasp, differ in no way from those who are asleep. Yet in deceiving themselves, they think themselves capable of seeing the natures of things with unerring reasoning, though each of the senses is an obstacle to knowledge, being bribed by sights, sounds, the qualities of flavors, and the peculiarities of odors, toward which it inclines and is dragged along, not allowing the whole soul to stand upright and to proceed without stumbling. As though along a highway, instead it produces the high made low, and the great made small, and everything akin to inequality and irregularity, and it forces the mind to reel and induces great dizziness. Since life, then, is so full of confusion, disorder, and obscurity, the statesman must come forward like a kind of sage in the art of dream interpretation, distinguishing the daylight dreams and phantoms of those who only seem to be awake by likely conjectures and reasonable probabilities, teaching about each thing that this is noble, that shameful, this good, that bad, this just, the opposite unjust. And so with the rest, the prudent, the courageous, the pious, the holy, the advantageous, the beneficial, and again the unprofitable, the irrational, the ignoble, the impious, the unholy, the disadvantageous, the harmful, the self-loving. And besides these, he must teach, this belongs to another, do not desire it. This is your own, use it without misusing it. You have more than enough, share it, for the beauty of wealth lies not in money bags, but in the relief of those in need. You possess little, do not envy those who have more, for no one would pity an envious poor man. You enjoy a good reputation and have been honored, do not grow arrogant. You are humbled by fortune, but do not let your spirit collapse. Everything is proceeding according to your mind, be on guard against change. You stumble often, hope for good things, for the turns of human affairs run toward their opposites. For the moon and the sun and the whole heaven possess clear and manifest brightness, since everything within it remains alike and is measured by the standards of truth itself, in harmonious order and the finest concords, whereas earthly things are full of much disorder and confusion, discordant and unattuned, so that one might most properly say that deep darkness has taken hold of these earthly things, while those heavenly things move within the most far-shining light, or rather are themselves the purest and cleanest light. If then, one should wish to look within into the nature of things, he will find that heaven is an eternal day, having no share in night or in any shadow, since it is illumined all through by unquenchable and undefiled radiance without interruption. And by as much as those of us who are awake differ from those who are asleep, by that much do the heavenly things differ from the earthly things in the whole cosmos. The heavenly things enjoy an unsleeping wakefulness because of their unerring, unstumbling activities that succeed in everything, while the earthly things are held fast by sleep. And even if they rouse themselves briefly, they are again dragged down and fall back asleep, because they are unable to look straight ahead with the soul, but wander and stumble. For they are darkened by false opinions, under whose influence they are compelled to dream, and, lagging behind the realities, are unable to grasp anything firmly and securely. Symbolically, then, he is said to mount to the second of the royal chariots, for the following reason. The statesman carries off the second prize after the king, for he is neither a private citizen nor a king, but stands on the border between the two, superior to the private citizen, yet inferior to the king in the exercise of unrestricted authority, since he makes use of the people as his king, on whose behalf he has chosen to do everything with pure and utterly guileless loyalty. He is borne aloft as if upon a chariot seat, lifted on high by both affairs and crowds, and especially whenever each matter, small and great, proceeds according to his mind, with nothing blowing against him or standing in opposition, but as in fair sailing, with all things being safely piloted by God. And the ring that the king gives is the clearest proof of the trust which the king's people have placed in the statesman, and which the statesman has placed in the ruling people. And the golden circlet about his neck seems to signify at once glory and punishment. For as long as the affairs of his statesmanship prosper for him, he is proud and dignified, being honored by the crowds. But whenever a misfortune occurs, not one arising from deliberate choice, for that would be culpable, but one due to chance, which is pardonable, he is nonetheless dragged down and humbled by that same ornament about his neck, as though his master were all but saying to him, "This circlet about your neck I gave you both as an adornment when my affairs prosper and as a noose when they fail." I heard, however, from those who study these matters more allegorically, another account of this kind. They said that the king of Egypt was our mind, the ruler of the bodily territory belonging to each of us, who like a king holds the power. This mind, once it becomes a lover of the body, labors over three things held in the greatest regard: food, delicacies, and drink, and for this reason employs three so-called overseers of these: a chief baker, a chief cupbearer, and a chief cook. One presides over eating, another over drinking, and the third is appointed over the seasonings that go with the delicacies themselves. All of these are eunuchs, since the lover of pleasure is barren of the most necessary things: self-control, modesty, self-mastery, justice, virtue entire. For nothing is so hostile to anything else as pleasure is to virtue, on account of which most people take no account of the one thing they alone ought to be concerned about, indulging their unrestrained desires and yielding to whatever these command. The chief cook, then, is neither led away to prison nor falls into any disgrace, because seasonings are not among the strictly necessary things. They are not pleasures themselves, but only easily quenched kindlings of pleasure. But of the two who labor over the wretched belly, the chief baker and the chief cupbearer, since eating and drinking are the most essential of life's necessities, when these are properly attended to, those in charge naturally receive praise, but when neglected, they are held worthy of anger and punishment. There is a difference, too, in the punishments, because the need is different. Food is most necessary, why not nearly so useful? Indeed, people live without strong drink, using spring water as their only drink. For this reason, there comes reconciliation and settlement with the chief cupbearer, as one who erred in the lesser matter. But the case against the chief baker is irreconcilable and unappeasable, receiving anger that reaches even to death, as one who wronged in the greatest matter. For death follows upon scarcity of food. This is why the one who sinned in this matter fittingly dies by hanging, suffering an evil like the one he inflicted, for he too had, as it were, hanged and stretched out on a rack the man made to hunger by famine. So much for this man. As for the one appointed viceroy of the king, who took charge and oversight of Egypt, he went out to make himself known to all the people of the country, and as he passed through the districts called nomes, city by city, he stirred in all who saw him an immense longing for himself, not only through the benefits he provided to each, but also through the ineffable and extraordinary graces that attended his appearance and all his other dealings with them. When, according to the interpretation of the dreams, the 7 years of abundance began first, he gathered a fifth of the produce every year, through the governors and the others who served him for the public needs, and amassed so vast a multitude of sheaves as no one before could remember ever having occurred. The clearest proof of this is that it could not even be counted, though countless men whose task it was labored with officious diligence to number it. When the 7 years had passed, in which the plain yielded abundant harvest, the famine began, and as it advanced and grew, Egypt could not contain it. For spreading out and ever seizing the cities and lands in succession, it reached at last to the very ends, both east and west, and overtook the whole inhabited world in a circle. It is said, indeed, that no common disease of such magnitude ever struck before, like the one the sons of physicians call herpes. For this, too, visiting every part, spreads the contagion of ulcerated flesh wholly through the whole body, step by step, in the manner of fire. So people chose from each place their most reputable men as grain buyers and sent them to Egypt. For already the foresight of the young man, who had stored up abundant food against the time of want, was being reported everywhere. He first ordered all the granaries to be opened, supposing that he would make those who saw them more cheerful, and would in a sense nourish their souls even before their bodies with good hopes. Then, through those he had entrusted with the task, he sold the grain rations to those who had the means to buy, always aiming at the future and seeing what was to come more precisely than what was present. Meanwhile, the father too, since necessities were already growing scarce, not knowing of his son's good fortune, sent 10 of his sons to buy grain, keeping at home the youngest, who was the full brother of the king's viceroy. And they, on coming to Egypt, approached their brother as a stranger, and astonished at the dignity surrounding him, bowed down to him according to ancient custom, his dreams already receiving their confirmation. But he, on seeing those who had sold him, recognized them all at once, while being recognized by none of them at all, since God did not yet wish the truth to come to light, for certain necessary reasons which it was then better to keep quiet. But rather he had either changed the appearance of the one entrusted with the land into a more majestic form, or had diverted the accurate perceptions of the minds of those who saw him. Then did he not, like a young man and successor to so great a rule, having assumed the office ranking first after the king, on whom east and west looked, exalted by the prime of his age and the greatness of his authority, having opportunity for vengeance, bear a grudge.